This upcoming concert season will be all about the boots, and Tecovas is your stop for the best in Western style. Tecovas has seasonal and limited edition offerings this spring and summer, including men's and women's boots, apparel, hats, bags, and more. All Tecovas boots are made by hand in a time-honored tradition with timeless styles that are always on trend. And Tecovas has first wear comfort with little to no break-in period. It's hard to find this level of comfort paired with this level of style. Stop by your local Tecovas store, have a complimentary drink or two, that's WCB style, and shop new styles. The smell of fresh leather and friendly staff are at your service. Many stores even have leather custom branding to make your boots truly personalized. And with regular live music and events, there's no in-store experience like it. If you can't make it into a store, just visit tecovas.com. That's T-E-C-O-V-A-S.com. They offer free shipping on all boots, as well as free returns and exchanges, and ship right to your door. Go to tecovas.com and find your new favorite pair of boots today.
Fishing like a local isn't just about catching fish. It's about connecting with the environment and the people who call it home. It's about hearing the stories and traditions that have been passed down for generations and sharing unforgettable moments with the people you meet along the way. Fishing like a local is having an experience that stays with you forever. And with Fishing Booker, you can experience it too, no matter where you are. Discover your next adventure on Fishing Booker.
Join Justin Townsend and the Harvesting Nature crew as they explore the world of cooking wild fish and game while sharing recipes, tips, tricks, and lessons learned from their pursuit of wild food. We sure hope you ate before the show, because you're going to leave hungry. This is the Wild Fish and Game Podcast.
That's super weird. All right, well, we'll see if they can hear us, but all right, we'll kick it off. So everybody, welcome back to Harvesting Nature's Wild Fishing Game Podcast. You got your host here, Justin Townsend, and joined by Casey today. And we're going to do, well, first off, we're live streaming. I don't think we've live streamed ever, so this is going to be the first time we're doing that, which should be pretty interesting. So everybody, send your comments, send your questions, and whenever we get to them at the end, we will answer them towards the end of the show. But what we're going to talk about today is kind of our 2023 elk hunting recap, and we're going to tie it in with some other concepts and stuff too. But I think the main point is to kind of give you a good synopsis of what we both went through in elk season, some highs, some lows, some missteps along the way. But either way, I think it'll be a fun little adventure we're going to take you on this evening. And, feel free, chime in. We'll get to you when we can, so we don't interrupt the flow of the show. But we're also recording this as a podcast. If you're a regular podcast listener, you're going to be listening to this. It'll come out next week. But first off, we'll give a quick updates on kind of what's going on in my neck of the woods. I literally just got back from elk hunting over this past weekend. I pulled back into town about noon today and got all my affairs settled and hit up Casey and was like, hey, let's brain dump all what's been going on. So here we are. We're really gearing up for a couple things. So we've got our Wild Pig Skills Camp coming up just next month, which will be back in Jacksboro, Texas. So this is, what, Casey, fourth iteration, I believe?
Yep. Yeah. Camp number four.
Pig Camp number four. So we've got three seats left, maybe two seats left for that camp. So really, just to give you a recap, in the 3 days we're there, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, which is, I think, the 7th, 8th, 9th, and 10th. Everybody departs on the 10th. We're going to teach folks how to shoot, butcher, process, and cook wild pigs that they hunt all in like that weekend. So pretty cool event that we're going to have, and excited to get back out and do it again. But We're going to follow that up in January. We're going to head to Oklahoma and do a wild duck or waterfowl camp with the folks from G&H Decoys there. We still got, I think, a full availability on that, but that'll be in Oklahoma. It'll be a cool little trip to go basically do the same thing, but with waterfowl. And then we're not guiding the hunting. It's going to be a DIY. We're going to hunt along with you guys. So that'll be pretty fun. Good use of it. That'll be the first time we're ever doing a waterfowl focused camp. So hopefully, it's as true as our pig camp is. It's fun. I know it's going to be fun, but, it'll be good to see some folks there. And then I don't know if you've been following weekly. We've been releasing these animal wild food focused shirts for the last, what, month or so, Casey, I think? Maybe a little more. A
couple of months. Yep.
So we've done white-tailed deer. We've done mule deer. We've done elk. We've done pheasant. We've done, like, game hunting dogs. Moose most recently.
More coming out soon.
Yeah, we got more coming out. We're trying to release them, but we're going to do these limited availability. So they're only going to be available till really the end of the year, and then we're gonna put them away until next year. So if you're looking for a good Christmas present for the duck hunter, deer hunter, elk hunter, whatever in your life, these are likely going to be them. They're pretty awesome designs we have on some great products. Casey's got a couple of them. I've got a couple of them. They wear pretty well. And then, I think really the big updates are to come from me. I don't know, Casey, you want to give a quick overview of what you got on your plate?
Yeah, we're going to dive into some more of it, but, the stuff that we're not going to cover, I've still got a Montana General deer tag, which is good for a couple more weeks. I think that closes the, Sunday after Thanksgiving. So hopefully get out there and try and fill that tag. Without going into all the painstaking details, I thought I was going to seal the deal on my biggest mule deer buck to date. And looking at the aerial maps, according to the lay of the land, the private boundary was where the hayfield ended and the public started where the natural grass started. And these deer were on the natural grass side. But according to the line distance, when I ranged them from my location to where they were at, it said they were about 40 yards past the boundary, and this is in an area with no fences. So I ended up passing on a buck that would have been my biggest to date, but certainly feel better about doing it that way and not getting myself into trouble or being gut sick over it after the fact. So hopefully get out there and have some more success in finding stuff. So. And then just an archery deer tag for South Dakota, and that goes through the end of the year. So plenty of time on that one still.
Awesome. No, it'll be good. I think I've switched over. I mean, maybe some big game left. I don't know. I'm trying to see if I'm going to head out to any other states to do any hunting or if it's just going to be kind of in Colorado. I've got a small game coming up. I also got my daughter enrolled in a waterfowl program here in Colorado. So there's it's like a couple of the sod farms here north of Denver. They'll have areas where they work with the state and you can come out and hunt those, but it's youth and a mentor only. So it'll just be her and I, and she has to shoot. She has to do all the things like first, but they provide the blind, they provide the decoys. You literally just like book the date and go out and do it. I think you have to attend a course beforehand, which we did. And in order to book it, and there's 5 blinds that are available, like I think Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, starting towards the end of November. And basically there's 5 blinds a day. There were only 7 families at this event. So like statistically, the way my mind works, right. I'm like, we got some good shots going. And then if you reserve it in the morning and go and you hunt and you close out and like it's 20 minutes from our house. So we could roll out in an afternoon. If the blinds closed out, we can hunt it. We don't even have to have a reservation.
That's a great program.
Yeah. So
I'm guessing that maybe it's like a depredation type hunt for, does the waterfowl wreak havoc on the sod farms? Or?
Yeah. Cause it's next to one of the big lakes. And so they'll just like leave the lake, come to the sod farm, go to the sod farm back. And they've been doing it for a while. I think, and everybody's been pretty happy with it. So, it's kind of cool, but let's see.
that does jog my memory. I'm usually so big game centric, especially when it comes to what ends up in the freezer. So it was nice. I was able to bag a snowshoe hare and a ruffed grouse on my last outing. So the family appreciated a little mix up from the standard red meat big game.
Yeah, I bet. So I'm trying to like arrange this window here. I don't know what's going on. There you go. Learning here oh, there we go. Learning how to live stream. It seems seems like it would be intuitive, but maybe not so much to me. But that's okay. All right. Well, let's talk about it a little bit. So what we'll do is I'll recap my kind of elk experiences this year, and we'll go from there. Casey's got a lot more elk experiences this year than I did, so I'll start off back in September in archery season. We were scheduled to go up on a trip with some of our friends up in the mountains to, we've heard of the 10th Mountain Division. They're the guys during like World War II. They trained here, in Leadville, at Camp Hale, and then they deployed to Europe, and they basically were like the Alpine fighters. So they used, they trained a lot around Camp Hale and up in the mountains in Leadville, and kind of up by the Vail area of okay. Colorado, along that like south of the sort of like, what is that, 70 corridor that goes through the mountains there. But they trained there, and so a lot of them came back and settled back in there, and a lot of them helped build the sort of ski industry as far as its like literal structure after World War II. And so they formed an association, the 10th Mountain Association, and they built these series of huts up in the mountains, like alpine, like 10, 11,000 feet up. And they have them available for rent in the summer and in the winter. And so this was sort of late fall that we were taking. In the winter, people will like ski up to them and take in all their gear and camp. The first time we went was, I think midsummer, we went to one and we had to drive like 8 or 10 miles down some pretty sketchy road. I broke my car, which still was able to get us home. but later the check engine light came on and I found I punched a hole in the, one of the like vacuum boxes for the fuel system. Man. So yeah, it was interesting. And the next one we went with a big group of families, and that was this one in September. And so I looked at the over the counter tags for archery, because I knew we were going up in September, and went ahead and pulled a cow tag, because that's a B tag in Colorado, and you can only have an A tag and a B tag, or two B tags per species, given the regulations. So I knew that this year I wanted to hunt A tag for a bull elk rifle, so I chose the B tag for the cow elk. So went up and did the whole, you know, camping thing, hanging out with everybody, and then decided that we were going to, I was going to go out. And so I took a couple of the teenage boys out with me, went and poked around a lot of sign. Unfortunately, no elk to be found. I think we spooked one. We were walking along a set of dark timber and I was blowing a cow call a little bit and heard the cow call back. And next thing you know, we round this bend and like something busts through the brush in a brown blur. And so I figure we either bumped a deer, or bumped a cow, but that was about it. There was a lot of water up there in September. We found, gosh, what would have been wallows last year were like full on ponds this year. So, you know, it wasn't even really worth like setting a wallow and just kind of waiting, because that there was just so much water everywhere. I mean, creeks were flowing, everything, just from the amount of snow and rain that we got over the past year. So excited to get out, excited, you know, to take a couple of the boys out and kind of get them a little in tune to elk hunting, but not necessarily profitable for the cooler, but that's okay. And then to sort of shift, I don't know, do you want to talk about yours chronologically? You want to talk about, you know, your first trip out or actually pulling tags?
Yeah, I think that makes sense. So I live in South Dakota, and it's not very easy to get elk tags here. So with that said, usually put in every year to try and pull an out-of-state elk tag. And so as most folks that hunt the West know, it's always kind of a cross your fingers situation, hoping that you pull a tag for the season. And found out that I got my general Montana elk tag, which I was super excited about. And my brother drew as well. So we started to make plans this spring when we found out. And then a few weeks later, I was checking my bank account and there was a $200 and some charge on there to go outside South Dakota. And I was like, what in the heck is this? And then it kind of dawned on me like, oh, that's the amount that a South Dakota elk tag is. I should probably check to see if tags have been drawn. And sure enough, I had drawn a Black Hills any elk tag, which for those that aren't familiar, the Black Hills are a small mountain range. The elk here are available to residents only, and it usually takes about 15 to 25 years to draw a tag. It's a preference point system, and then once you draw that tag, you can't even apply again for 9 years. And then after the 9 year wait period, you can start applying again. Like I said, it takes, you know, 15 to 25 years, which who knows in 30 or 40 years what that point system will be like, if you'll even be able to draw again. So with that said, I was fortunate enough to draw my Black Hills elk tag, and I already had a Montana elk tag in my pocket. So that was a first for me. At that point, I kind of stopped applying for everything because I didn't need more deer tags or things like that. I was like, if I'm able to get one, if let alone two, I'll be sitting good on the meat department. So our first trip out was for Montana archery season. So similar time frame to when you were hunting your cow. And we went out for about 10 days. It started off really hot. We went to an area we'd been familiar with where I'd seen some elk last year, and all this stuff said we were hitting it just right. Like the moon phase was perfect. It said they should be in peak rut. We got there, and within 30 minutes of the first morning, we were into elk, like right away. First bugle out of the truck, we got a response. Within half an hour of that, it was shooting light and we were seeing elk. And within another half hour, my brother was able to call a bull in. For me, we saw this bull come in to about 50 yards. I had ranged a tree, that I thought he would step in front of. And he did. Unfortunately, he came up like a half step short. So his vitals were covered by a tree, and there was maybe a dinner plate size gap that I could have tried to shoot through. But again, we were like an hour into our trip. So it was like, there's elk everywhere. They're talking like crazy. I'm not going to try and force a shot. You know, we'll be back on more elk. So he ended up blowing off. That first day, we probably saw and or got into about 10 elk. We saw several other small bulls that day. Lots of bugling, which is always fun. And so we were on cloud nine that first day. It was like, we didn't punch a tag, but things are looking good. We've got 9 more days to go. Like, it's going to happen. And it was just like somebody turned the lights out. It was like it went from being super hot to quiet. We put on a lot of miles. We covered some ground, you know, in the truck, just getting to different areas, getting to places we could glass. But the bugling action slowed way down. We knew we were still in areas with elk. We were still on fresh sign. And we would see elk from a distance on occasion, but we weren't getting anything to respond. We weren't getting anything to come in. We made some like long spot and stalk type plays on stuff, which is fun, but it's not like the quintessential September rut crazy action that you're expecting. So I don't know if it was weather cycle or hunter pressure or what, but that was the first time for me. I've been elk hunting for 4 or 5 years now. That was the first time for me to have it switch so drastically from one day to the next like that. But it was a grind. I always tell my wife, cause I'm grateful for her for taking care of the kid and the house and the dog and everything when I'm gone. I always try and tell her, like, I promise this is not a vacation. I'll be far more exhausted when I get home than when I leave.
Yep.
So it was a grind while we were gone, but that was kind of the story of archery season. And we got back the third week of September. And my Black Hills tag opened on October 1st. It's a rifle tag. So I had about 10 days to really hit the ground hard scouting in South Dakota to try and get a bead on where I wanted to start opening day for rifle season here in South Dakota. So I don't know if you want to touch on kind of the next wave of your season, or you want me to just keep trudging through?
No. I'll talk. So I guess I was going to ask, I had a couple questions based off what you had there. So is this an area you guys normally go to every year, or is it a new area, or how do you guys decide that?
Yeah. We like to be mobile. I think you're the same in a lot of ways. The elk are where you find them, as the saying goes. And that changes drastically from year to year. So, there was a 2-year period where, my brother and I were fortunate enough to get 3 bulls out of 1 drainage. I mean, we shot 3 bulls within a 500 yard radius of each other. And so, in your mind, you're like, oh, this is the honey hole, you know, like there's elk here. You're going to be successful all the time. Well, after 2 years of success, the last few years in that location have just been, couldn't have been more dead. No, like not even fresh sign. Hardly any elk scat whatsoever. Any rubs are, you know, 2 to 3 years old. There was a weather shift. So kind of that area used to be kind of a riparian zone with lots of green grass and a creek running through it. In the last few years has turned pretty dry and arid. I'm not sure if that's what's pushed them out of the area. There's a lot of black bear in that area as well, which could contribute to the change. But all that to say, we try and stay mobile. So we ended up putting a lot more miles on the truck this year driving, just trying to locate stuff. And then, you know, whether we needed to move camp or make a play from there. We hunted, I would say, maybe 2 core areas that we were familiar with. And we branched out into 3 or 4 new areas that, you know, we had either gotten a tip on or, you know, was like, oh, we saw an elk herd here 2 years ago on a summer trip in July. Let's go back and check that area and see if there's anything there this time of year, which is, you know, it's fun. It's the upside to not getting into elk right away is it pushes you out of your comfort zone and you go check out new areas and yeah. Find new spots. So that part of it is exciting, but it definitely put some more miles on the truck, went through some gas. But
when you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
I think it's a good segue into sort of like a concept I wanted to mention before I sort of talk about my experience this last weekend. And I'll preface it with saying, like, Casey mentioned it earlier of like the mobility of it. And I've had this approach, I think, for the last probably 5 or 6 years since I've been hunting out west, is like, there's a sense of movement that you kind of have to have. I see a lot of folks, you know, whether they're successful or not is to be determined, but we'll get in a spot and camp in a spot, like both literally and physically, for the entirety of that season. And if they're not seeing anything, they just kind of like make do. The other part of it too is like, I see a lot of like kind of like that road hunting too. I mean, we've all do it and we use it as a tool to scout with, but like just driving the roads in hopes of like seeing an animal, you know, within shooting distance, I think there's a definitely school of thought that abides by that. But I think when we talk about the mobile hunter, I'll throw out this term, and it's really like the modern mobile Western hunter. And when Casey and I were talking before, the way I really introduced it as is it's like kind of your elk hunter that you think's like living in the back of his truck. He's hunting the whole season, like traveling around doing whatever. And I think it's like a concept like that, but the way that I have operated with it, and AJ and I hunted a lot this way in Wyoming, is like you pick your base, you know, be it a campsite, a camper, a hotel room, a motel room in a lot of places, or like an Airbnb or whatever. And you're basing yourself out of there, and you may have a game management unit, may have a zone, whatever each state calls it, but you come into it sometimes with no experience in this area at all. It happened this way. We went out to Oregon and hunted bears 3 years ago. It's happened in Wyoming. It was like this past weekend with me, where you go in, you kind of like, it's to travel far enough that you haven't had time to go scout it, or maybe you just haven't had time. And, you know, I've read a lot of disparaging Facebook comments from people when folks are out looking for help, or, you know, looking for whatever. And folks are like, oh, well, you should have scouted. Well, plain and simple, not everybody's got time to dedicate to go out scouting, especially when I'm hunting someplace 3, 4, 5, 6 hours away. I've got a full-time job. I've got Harvesting Nature. I've got kids. I got commitments, family, all that stuff. And it's just, face it, you don't always have that. So you have to kind of think on your feet. And I think the concept of like e-scouting is a big thing of like, all right, well, we know public lands are here. We know, you know, elk are going to reside in this area. You know, I watch the weather patterns a lot too. And it's hard with elk. Just like Casey mentioned, where the elk are at in July is not where the elk at are going to be in September. It's not where the elk are going to be at in November. And I think that like rings true just about any place in the West you are. It's just like the elk are going to move with the weather patterns and with hunting pressure and with all the other things. So being mobile gives you that ability to like, all right, today we're going to hunt this. All right, we're not seeing anything here. We're not seeing sign. We're not seeing, you know, we're not hearing bugles. We're not doing anything. So boom, let's cross this off on a list. Like, let's move. And, you know, I think on average, and I think Casey, you're probably the same way, probably like between 3 and 5 days, it usually takes me to like get dialed in enough to where it's like, all right, I'm on animal now. Like, I'm seeing animals. I'm feeling comfortable. Like, this is good. But those, like, really, those first 2 days are just a complete wash. I may not see any animal at all. And I think it's important to, like, stick to the plan, because it can often get super frustrating to be like, I haven't seen an animal in 2 days. I'm not seeing sign. Like, what's going on? Is it me? Is it you? Is it the animal? Like, what is it? And 99% of the time, it's just, it's the animal and you're not in the right spot. So you just got to kind of keep going, keep playing those cycles of like where you want to be, what you're trying to do. And the other thing I think is like there might be a reluctancy to shift. I see some people are like, no, I picked this spot. Like, this is where I'm going to go. That ridge top over there, I'm going to sit there every day until that deer, that elk or whatever walks through. Well, that may not happen. It may happen, but it may not happen. So I think being willing to shift your plan is probably one of the biggest things. And then, man, I think back to like, I remember when Onyx first came out and I was hunting antelope in 2015 in Wyoming. And we were like playing the guessing game. And we were hunting a patch of BLM that a friend had taken us to. We happened to be in the local watering hole that night, and AJ was chatting with this guy, and he's like, hey man, have you ever heard of this app called Onyx Maps? And we're like, no, like, what is this? And he pulled it out and showed us. And, you know, AJ downloaded it that night after we got the little like tutorial on it. And the next day we used it, and we both went out like east of town on this little like a quarter mile by 1 mile sliver of BLM land, and we both shot antelope off of it. Like, you would have driven by it on the road and not even known. Right. It's insane. So that I'd say coupled with like local knowledge, build relationships, talk to people, see what's working, see what's not working, get in, always helps too. And of course, never head out and ask for people's honey hole or things like that. But you can have a conversation with someone about like without asking, like, "Hey, where are the deer at?" I think is an important thing too, and just be cognizant of that. I don't know, Casey. Do you think I missed any the modern mobile Western hunter concept?
I think you touched on most of it. I mean, just me personally, I fish and hunt in the same manner, in the sense that I am not going to burn a lot of time in one place if I feel like my odds of success are really low. So, you know, going back to the season, for instance, my brother and I got into the elk like crazy that first day, and naturally we went back to the same place the next day, crickets. And so we gave it a day off. We visited it on the the fourth day, crickets again. And that was it. We didn't go back. And it doesn't mean there couldn't be elk there, but if you're on a 10-day hunt, how many days do you want to spend in the same place where you're not seeing success?
One.
Not a lot. And so that, you know, that's why I say I do that when I'm fishing. If I'm fishing, I cast, and if there's a honey hole, I'll cast there 3 or 4 times. And if I don't get a bite, I'm probably moving down to the next hole. I'm set on being mobile. I'd rather increase my odds, or at least feel like I'm increasing my odds by being mobile and seeing new country and trying a new spot, than sitting and crossing my fingers that something's going to walk by. I don't know if that's a byproduct of whitetail hunting being the predominant big game that's targeted in the U.S., but I think a lot of people get in that whitetail mindset of, like you said, I just have to sit here and wait for something to walk by. And in the elk world, they're so migratory in certain areas. The environment, the climate, the pressure can change their habits so much. I think you see a lot of people burn through a season. And like you said, maybe not see an animal just because they're stuck to that one ridge. And we're creatures of habit. And so it'd be easy for, you know, like my brother and I to go back to that gully where we shot our bulls in the past and say, well, we did it before, it's going to happen here again. Mm-hmm. But if everything else is telling you that that's not the place, listen to your intuition and go start checking some other spots.
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head with the last one. And I too, like, I was guilty of this. So I drew, so my background too, like, grew up whitetail hunter, stand hunting, all that stuff, in Oklahoma, and like shifting out to West was a big mentality. And I think that was one of the first, realizations that we had hunting antelope, was like, you can't hunt antelope like you hunt whitetail. You can't, like, you know, expect them to come waltzing through, or, you know, sit somewhere if there's nothing there. Like, you got to kind of be on the move. And I think that set a good foundation. But it was some hard lessons learned before we figured that out. The second thing I was going to say is like that point of, I played it. So 2 years ago, Colin came out and we hunted mule deer in Eastern Colorado. We spent 2 days cruising around the unit, like looking for sign, looking for animals, all that. And finally, like, I think it was the evening of the second day, we'd probably put in 10 miles or so worth of hiking and scouting and all that. I mean, we were hunting, we weren't scouting, but we'd taken Zoe, my daughter, with us too. And we got to the last spot I wanted to check out for the day. And I was like, that's it. This bluff. I could see it out there. I was like, we want to go here. But I wasn't for sure if we could drive on the road, which went about halfway out because it was like national grassland. So I was like, I'm not sure. I don't have signal. I can't check the map. So let's walk it. And Zoe looked at me and she's like, Dad, do we have to? Like, I'm exhausted. And for a girl who was 9 at the time, I was like, I don't want to push her too much into it. So we're going to stop. And so we went back home. Well, the next day, Colin and I went out there, and Colin ended up shooting his first mule deer. I passed on several doe, and, you know, we had a great hunt. Fast forward to this year, I put in and drew that same tag again out of the leftovers list. And I just, like, I had 1 or 2 days to hunt.
and ended up having to take the kids with me. And I just like dreamt about going to this bluff, same concept, because we went up this bluff, hiked up to the top, looked over to the right, like there were deer on a fence line, looked over to the left, there were deer on the fence line. We saw this like monster buck with like barbed wire wrapped around its antlers come walking through while we were out there. And then we're like cleaning Collins' deer, quartering it up, and another deer comes through. And I'm just like, this is like the magical deer bluff. And I just had that in my mind, and I just like would dream about it leading up, you know, the days up to this hunt. And we got up to this bluff on the day of the hunt, and I carried Remy up. He's my youngest, and carried him up, and we got up to the top, and we got all set up, and nothing. And we sat there for 3 hours and nothing. And, you know, I timed it wrong. We ended up leaving early. The kids got impatient and stuff like that. But I was like, man, oh man, is this so much different than I envisioned in my head? And I got caught up, and I was like, you got caught up in your own like concept of like, you were like, I'm so fixated on this place, I'm not going to look anywhere else. I did mark some other spots, which we went and checked out, but it's just like, I got caught up.
It's very easy to do.
Yeah.
I one tidbit in maybe like a cookie crumb for part of the later discussion is have a backup plan, which I think, you know, is kind of what part of what we've circled around, and also pay attention to the areas around where you're hunting that maybe seem like they would never make sense. Or it'd be like, most states have some form of private land open to public hunting. There's some of those areas where it's like you drive by and you're like, I can't picture a deer or an antelope or anything living out in this, you know, short grass prairie or cornfield or whatever it is that you're seeing. But, make note, remember where those places are. We'll talk a little bit more about it later, but yeah, it's so easy to get in that mindset of I've had success here before, this is where it's going to happen. And it's a good spot to start. Like, you know, it's a whole lot better than starting with a blank slate and not knowing where to look. But yeah, it is easy to fall into the trap of like, oh, this is where it's going to happen.
Man, you are the eggs in that basket. You're the king of segues tonight. And I'll say that. So, all right, let's talk about my elk rifle experience. So I decided to pick up the over-the-counter third season tag, which is it opens Saturday the 11th, and it closes on the 17th of November, which is coming up as we're recording this. And I had planned a total of like 3 to 4 days based on my off days for the Veterans Day holiday to go up and hunt. And I had no idea where I wanted to go. I had no idea what I wanted to do. I just knew that I wanted to go hunt elk somewhere in Colorado, because this is probably my last season out here because I'm moving in the summer. But I didn't have an idea where I wanted to go. I had an idea where I've gone in the past and the units I've hunted in the past, and I was like, I don't really want to go there. We got hit hard in some of the far northwest units. Actually, one where I went last year, where there were a ton of elk. Now there's not a lot of elk due to some of the winter kills, so much so that they limited tags there this year, and they limited the amount of time. So instead of it being a full, like, I think, what is it? 7 day season, 5 day season there now. So it ends early, for the over the counter, stuff, but, to all the guides in Colorado at the Guide Association agreed to not guide in that zone this year or unit this year. So kind of shows you the severity of what happened. So as that all occurred, I was picking out units, and I selected to go to, I wouldn't say close unit, but I picked a unit. I looked at the amount of public land available, the amount that was accessible, and looked in there, and there was a town I was going to base myself out of, and I decided that's where I was going. And I don't typically solo hunt a lot. Normally I hunt with folks. It could be anywhere from like
one buddy to apparently a whole camera crew sometimes. But at this one, I ended up going solo, which was cool. I shot out some invites to some folks and the scheduling didn't line up, which is no big deal. Also, had a busy couple weeks, so I was looking to kind of like just chill, which is exactly what happened. And then the whole e-scouting thing, I picked one, two, three, four spots in this zone, varying on elevation, access, type of land, all this stuff like that. And what I typically look for is obviously public land that's accessible. I don't like stuff that's right off the road, but I will check those spots out as I'm like on my way. But it really is dependent on when I get there. And so I left Saturday morning first off and headed up. And my first plan was I was not going to check in my hotel. I was going to go up and hunt the evening hunt. And I got up there and it was cold and windy. And so I picked this spot on the far north side of the unit. Like it was probably, I don't know, 20 minutes from Wyoming. And I chose that spot and went up. And it was probably, I would say, almost 10,000 feet up. And that's important because Colorado elk are very migratory as they are everywhere else. We've had a mix of snow. And so the elk are going to push down if there's no food sources available up top. Otherwise, they don't really have a reason to come down. And so I got up to where I picked. I passed so many people camping on the forestry land on the way up. And so many people driving like side by sides and all these other things. And so like some red flags were going off in my mind. It's thick timber. And I was like, man, let me get up here to this spot where I wanted to go. I parked. There was another person up there already parked. I think they were like napping in their truck or something. But I found a clear cut where they had power lines. And I said, I'm going to go sit on this clear cut, at least for the time being. And I headed over there and sat down. Didn't see any elk sign, but I noticed that as I walked over, there were like clumps of snow, clumps of grass. Some of the grass was full tall. Some of it looked like somebody had taken a lawnmower and mowed it down. And so it was maybe like just a couple inches tall. And I was like, I think elk are feeding off this grass or something is deer, elk, whatever. So I sat there for a while and just kind of waited and watched. It got colder. And then probably two ridges over, I see like people on a side by side go up the clear cut. And I was like, well, I'm obviously not going to see elk over there now. And then like some hunters come in behind me. And then I see another side by side come through just like probably 300 yards away from me. So I'm like, this is not looking great. So I decided for the sake of mobility that I had probably about an hour and a half left until sunset. So I went ahead and pulled chocks, hopped in the vehicle, and I drove across the road to this other set of forestry land. That was even more packed, and it was a lower elevation. And like every turn I made, there were people there. That was the theme of my adventure here into the foray. But it was, man, I would say it was frustrating, but I'm like, you think big, wide open spaces. And I've heard people in Colorado call it like the Orange Army and all those things like that. But I never thought it was going to be as it was. And so I ended up talking to some guys who were like, we haven't seen elk. We haven't seen anything. And in my mind, I'm like, well, you guys are like 8,500 feet. Like we've dropped down 1,000 feet in elevation from where I was before. Like, I don't think they're here. It's too warm down here. They're not going to shift down. So I called it a night and I went out to another spot that I hadn't marked, but I was doing some mental math and I picked it. So my frustration lied in the vehicles and the ease of travel. So I was like, all right, I'm going to go with some state trust land. Nobody can drive on that. It's adjacent to the state park. Nobody can drive on that off designated roads. So I should be good. Drive out there. Guess how many vehicles are parked in the parking lot?
20.
And there was four people camping in like guide tents nearby as well. So I was like, man, but I was like, I've got a plan in my mind. I'm going to find this ridge. I'm going to hike in. My goal is I'm going to hike in further than I think anybody's going to hike. And so I probably went 2 miles in, set up on top of this ridge, and I'll post this picture. It's like a beautiful ridge across from me. It's the, as the mountains come down the slope, it's all state forest, and it's varying elevation levels anywhere between like 8,500 on up to like probably 95 to 10. And there's clear cuts, there's draws, there's all kinds of stuff. And I'm like, this is perfect. I'll sit here and I've got probably, you know, a mile and a half worth of glassing across the face of me that I can do. And so that's just what I did. I just sat there and I glassed for 3 hours. And then as I was like halfway through my glassing on that same ridge, which they must have come up through the state park side, I see a blaze orange. And then about 100 yards from him, I see another blaze orange. And I was like, all right, well, that portion of the glassing is done. And I was looking at the map and I was like, if I head north further, so further away from the parking lot, deeper into the public land, there's some more spots I can glass and set up. So I packed up all my stuff and I started heading north and got into, literally rounded the bend, and the ridge where I wanted to set, or actually cross and then go down and back up, there was a group of 5 people hunting together. 5 guys sitting on like the knoll of a ridge. Just like, I was like, oh man. So I, at that point, super frustrated, just like packed up my gear and left. And then I made the best choice I made all the weekend was some of the state parks in Colorado, you can hunt for big game. And I was like, cool. State park, lot of land, you have to pay to access it. So some people are going to be deterred by that fact. And I was like, then the roads are mostly closed except for designated ones. There's designated trails so I can get up high, because at this point in my mind, I'm like, I'm not seeing elk sign down low. I saw it up high. I need to get higher. I need to get high. I need to get away from people. And so that's exactly what I did. I got to the state park, paid my entry, drove down this winding road, got to the end of the where the trailhead was, and guess what? There were like 5 people camped there. And I was like, oh, gosh. Well, I've got feet. I can move. And I looked at this particular trail, and I think it was 8 miles up to like an alpine lake. And I was like, I'm obviously not going to go that far. It's like, I think 1 o'clock in the afternoon this time. And I was like, I'm going to go in up as high as I can, as far as I can, until I have to turn around to make it back out before dark, because this park is also full of moose. And also there's like wolf signs, not sign. There's wolf signage all around. Not that I'm concerned too much with wolves, but I play a cautious tale. I'm solo hunting too. So I'm like, I'm checking in and out with my wife via my phone, like, hey, here's my coordinates. I'm going in. I'll be back out. If I'm not out, like, here's where my van's at. And so I head in, fairly uneventful. And I'm at like 3.5 miles up and in. And I've climbed an elevation. I can tell you exactly how high I've climbed an elevation. A fair bit here. So much so that I'm starting to second guess myself.
That is one of the downsides of OnX, is the line distance feature. Cause you can guesstimate, that's not that far.
Yeah.
And without jumping into your story, one spot in Montana, it took my brother and I almost an hour to go 300 yards. So yeah. It can vary drastically.
I get like 3.5 miles in and I'm like, all right, I'm like frustrated. I'm not seeing any sign. I'm still seeing people tracks. I'm seeing like bicycle tracks, horse tracks. There's like logging truck tracks through here. And I'm like, man, this is just not, and I'm not feeling well. I started not feeling well like that morning, actually the night before. I got an earache, and then kind of the elevation was messed with my ears and stuff too, sinus pressure and all that. So I'm cruising along and I around the corner and I start to notice elk sign, And I look at my altitude map and I'm at like 9,200 feet. And I'm like, all right, between 9 and 10 is about where I expect to start seeing elk. I'm starting to see elk sign. I'm like, all right, this is like a little more hopeful. And then I round the bend again and I'm like in these logged clear cuts, probably a year old, maybe two. And I had signal, so I text Colin. I was like, hey, man, this reminds me of like when we were in Oregon hunting bear and like seeing elk and bear in the clear cuts. Like it's kind of cool. It was a cool moment. And I'm kind of like, you know, it picked me up a little bit. I'm bebopping along. And I make this little bend and I look over and up on one of the clear cuts, I see a herd of cows. And I'm like, hey, that's a herd of cows. This is great. Now I'm like, I'm excited. So I'm like, glass them up a little bit. What I can see through like some short trees. What I see is all cows. So I was like, all right, let me push a little more. Then I kind of push through this short growth of trees and then get over to the edge and look back up where I can see the full herd now. And, it was all, probably year or two old elk. No tines, just straight antlers. And then just cows, so probably about 15, 18 of them. But man, I'd hope. And at that point, I was in at probably 3.5 miles, and I was nearing up on time to like turn around. And I was like, nope, I'm like now in this series of clear cuts, like rolling clear cuts for the next mile. And so like I just like banged it out. And in my mind, every next clear cut was a bull elk because I was hunting the over-the-counter tag, which is a bull only, and this unit was four tines on one side. So if I'd had a cow tag, I was fairly confident at 230 yards, I would have been packing out a cow, which would have been great. But alas, I did not see any elk, and I wrapped up my packed back out quickly and got out of there just right before dark. And did not feel super well last night, so I went out this morning and looked at a couple spots I was going to go to that I had e-scouted, because I was like, I don't have time to do the 4 mile hike back in up to the top, nor did I have the energy, because I think I did a total of 13 miles that day. So I was pretty beat, and then not feeling well the night before. I just decided to call it kind of early this morning and drive back home. But also too, the spots I checked out were full of people. And I was just like, I was driving down the road and I was like, I'm going to drive down this road. There's an endpoint I want to get to. But if I pass 5 campsites, I'm turning around. And within 5 minutes, I passed 6. And I was like, I'm turning around. I was like, I can't. I'm not even going to go down this road anymore. Because it was the same thing. Like, even when I was up at the state park, like in the campsite, as I was got back and got my gear and I was watching people come back to their camps, people were just cruising the roads. Like I saw a guy on a four-wheeler cruising the road in the state park, like looking for elk, not because he can't take his ATV off on some places. But that's when it hit me. I was just like, I just want to tell somebody, like, one, this is a cool spot to go. You should go find the elk here. But two, like, you're too low. You got to go higher. And I wanted to share the information and I didn't get to share it with anybody. But I think it was a cool experience. I took a lot away from it. And I've like sharpened my steel at elk hunting. Like I've trusted my instinct and it got me into elk, but still like a little frustrated. I didn't walk away with an elk, but yeah. I don't know. I think,
do you know yet if you're going back out before the season wraps up, or is that it for you?
I think that's it. All I'd have is Friday, and it would be a stretch to get up and out. I'd have to take off from work, and the stars would have to align. So I think, unfortunately, that's going to be it for me. I may look at – there's the Eastern Plains elk tag, and there's some very remote herds of elk around in the eastern side that I might go out and try to go to, but it may just be small game and waterfowl in Colorado at least, and see what other opportunities present themselves. I don't know. Let's shift over. Your story is much more entertaining because you've got two states.
So, got back from archery season in Montana with about a week or so to run trail cameras. And I guess I'll preface this with, I'm not like a bona fide trophy hunter. I like a lot of people appreciate like a big buck or a big bull, but like number one purpose is to bring some meat home. That was a weird part about drawing this South Dakota tag is being essentially a once in a lifetime tag. The area is known for not world class bulls, but like very, very, you know, nice bulls and high success rate. So once you pull that tag, there's an abnormal amount of pressure that you're going to succeed and that you have to succeed by getting, you know, a certain caliber of elk, which was different for me. I've never felt that amount of pressure or anxiety about like having to succeed in that way. So with that said, I had a handful of trail cameras running all summer and I was checking those and moving them around the last few days before season. And kind of had narrowed in on a couple of bulls that I wanted to try and find, October 1st on opening day. The last 2 days before season, I was able to go to that zone and get on elk right away in the morning. Obviously less pressure, when it's not actually season. So, they were in full rut at that time. So I was able to bugle and cow call and get in on stuff every morning leading up to the season. But knew I would have more competition, more people out hunting on opening day. So first day out, hiked in about 2.5. I should also say I'm a little OCD about getting in what seems like atrociously early. If there's a spot that I want to get to, my brother can attest to that, via his lack of sleep during the hunting season. I think, you know, let's say legal shooting light was like 6:30. I think I parked at the trailhead at like 3 a.m.
Holy smokes.
And started hiking in. So hiked in the dark for a few hours, went in about 2.5 miles to a high point on a burn where I had seen him the 2 days before. Not a lot of action that opening morning. There was some hunters maybe about 1.5 miles down the ridge from me. Did hear one gunshot and a couple of bugles. Pulled out, back to the truck, ended up relocating, to an area that I had some additional trail camera footage of, and actually passed on my first bull elk that first day. So the evening of the first day, I got into some elk, two bulls that were just rut fest like crazy, bugling back and forth, and I was able to get in the middle of them. But the timber was too tight. I was essentially hunting them like archery season, but with a rifle. I got within 60 yards of them and I could see them through the jack pines, but you know, just no clear shot. And they ended up bumping off. And so when I got through the short pines, I was able to glass up either the same bull with cows or a different bull with cows, I'm not sure, up about 2 miles on a ridge line. And I knew that there was a dead end for a service road that went about around the back end of that ridge line. So hauled back to the truck quick, got in and relocated. Funny side bit. There's like a squatter that's living on the back side of that mountain. And so it was like really weird to like try and get around this person that's squatting there and they're janky old camper without, you know, making a ruckus, but got by them just fine, got to the end of the trail. And the elk were right where I thought they might be. I saw the cows moving along the hill and I thought that I'd maybe bumped them, but they were just moving along the ridge line. And then sure enough, that herd bull was on the back end of them. And, I had him at about 110 yards, for long enough that I could glass him up and tell that he wasn't quite the caliber of bull that I wanted to shoot on opening day. So that was the first time in my life I'd ever passed on a bull elk. Might be the last time in my life I ever passed on a bull elk. Not sure, but, check that box. I can say I've done it. I'm capable of it. That was on a Sunday. So then I had to work the next couple of days. So I got out for an hour here, hour and there, I did get on to elk or hear elk every day, which was good. And then on October 4th, I guess I should go back a little bit. On October 3rd, I had gotten into some elk right at last light, and there was one very nice bull that I had located prior to the season that I was able to get on to October 3rd. But by the time I got to him and his cows, it was like the last couple of minutes of legal shooting light. And so for anybody that's hunted in that time of day, it's a lot harder to find stuff in your scope. You really want to know your target because, visibility is just more limited. So I had maybe one or two quick windows where I had him identified, but he had like 30 cows. And every time I had him, there was two or three cows in front of him or behind him. And so I wasn't able to make it work. But then I knew they were at where they were at, and I hadn't bumped them off that night. It was like 20 mile an hour winds. So they didn't even know I was there. So the next day, the 4th, I went right back to the same spot again at like 3 a.m. And, driving into that location, I actually had a herd, and a couple of bulls go across the Forest Service trail in front of me right before I was going to park at this trailhead. And I hadn't seen the bull that I was after, but I saw a bull, and I had kind of assumed that maybe that was his herd. I did go back to the trailhead and bugle a couple of times, didn't hear anything. So I just made the assumption that he was with that group. They had moved on to another hillside. And I took a road that kind of looped a long ways to the west of where they were located. And still with it being 3 a.m. Again, one of the perks of not sleeping during hunting season is you have a lot of extra time to audible before first light. And so I had time to drive about half an hour to the backside of this hill that they had moved up to, and hiked in about a mile and a half, and got to be where it was just about first light. And I cracked off and let a bugle out and got a response right away. And they weren't very far. They were maybe 200 to 300 yards away downhill from me at that point. And so I made a move towards them, had the wind good. Again, another low light situation, but in reverse, where I was getting more and more light by the minute. And so it was low visibility to start, and I ended up actually bumping them just a little bit. They didn't wind me, but I think they just saw movement in the trees. And I saw a bull standing on a tree line at like 80 yards away, and he had me pegged. So I just stood motionless for a couple of minutes, and he just stared at me. And slowly turned and walked away, and they went up the ridge straight away from me. And so I thought they had bumped. But at that point, you're not really out anything. And so I just moved quietly through the trees in their direction. And within a minute, I realized they had just, fed up the hill essentially. And they had stopped after like 100 yards. So, I got in again, and it was a really steep pitch hill. So, the jack pines thinned out into more mature pines, and then, granite rock faces at a really steep angle. I'm downhill, they're above me, and I could see the cows moving around on the ridge. I knew there was a herd bull with them, but couldn't locate him. So I was kind of, skipping from tree to tree, trying to locate where the bull was at. And I was able to find him, just via his body color. He had been rutting up in a wallow, and so he was a lot darker than the cows. And so I found that dark body running around in between all the cows. And I let him come into a clearing, at like 120 yards, and I cow called and he stopped. And at this point, having passed up a bull, having had, almost gotten the bull that I had really been after the day before, I feel like my anxiety had just gotten to the point where I was just like, I need to shoot a bull. Like, I had come to peace with the fact that, like, it might not be like a record breaking giant, but like, I'm going to be happy with any mature elk at this point. Like, my nerves were getting to me. And so I knew he was the herd bull. He came to the opening. I cow called. He stopped. Got a shot off. I knew it was a good hit. they all started to take up over the ridge. There was only like 20 more yards left of this hillside before they dipped over another ridge. And so he was herding, kind of fell to the back of the herd. All the cows dumped over the backside. And he came into a clearing where I had one more shot right before he went over the edge. Made another shot, knew I hit, saw him go over the ridge and listened intently. I was thinking like I maybe heard a crash, but I wasn't sure. And so I just hung back, texted my brother. I said, "Hey, I shot an elk. I think I got a bull. I'll let you know." And I stayed there for about an hour, which for anybody that has been in that situation is knows that it's a gut wrenching time period when you're,
that is
you're
an giving, exercise in patience to sit there an hour.
When you don't see the animal go down and you're like, the responsible move is to give it some time before pushing it. I felt good about the shots, but I didn't see it go down. And so I gave it an hour and I moved up to the first shot location, which was about 60 to 80 yards closer than the second location, thinking I'll get on blood right away and then I'll just be able to blood trail him over the ridge and know where he went over at. Well, I got to where he was and there's no blood. And for anybody that hasn't elk hunted a lot, elk don't bleed very much in a lot of situations. There's exceptions to every rule, but in comparison to, you know, deer, for instance, elk just don't bleed that much. And so I got to where I'd hit him and I actually found his tracks, just based off of size. And there was a bunch of large rocks that he had kicked over. So I started to just follow his tracks, but didn't see any blood. And, you know, your heart starts to drop every time you like take a couple of steps and you still don't see any blood. And so I kept going up the hill, kept not seeing blood, kept getting more worried. And finally made it all the way up to the top of the hill where I had shot him the second time, still no blood. And I was like, you know, really not feeling great at this point. You know, everything starts going through your mind. Mm-hmm. And I had marked the tree. There was two small trees that he went between when he went over. So I was like, all right, I know he went over right between these trees. I'm just going to go to that edge, take a peek over. If I don't see any blood or sign, I'll back out and give him another hour or two. And so I walk between these two small trees. And then sure enough, he's laying right on the other side of the tree. He hadn't gone more than like 10 yards after the second shot, but he had just fallen right out of view. And there he was. So it was a beautiful backdrop. It was, you know, like right at the start of fall. So you have all the bright yellows bursting out of the pines and right at sunset or sunrise, essentially. So it was, couldn't have asked for a prettier backdrop, and was able to, and I was solo hunting, so was able to start getting him butchered, and my brother was able to come up later that afternoon and help pack him out. So that was a, you know, a 4-day season for a tag that I'll probably never have again, but it ended well, and yeah, I was super excited about it. So that was kind of like part one to the elk season.
Okay. And take a brief intermission to have a sip of beer.
Yeah. At that point, it's like a successful. Anytime you kill an animal the size of an elk or a moose or something like that, it's kind of a sigh of relief. And you're like, oh, I've got a full freezer for, you know, the next year, year and a half or whatever it is.
Yeah. I remember texting you and we were going to meet or something. And you're like, actually, I've got to like get the whole family over. We're like processing the elk.
Yeah, it's been
great.
We've kind of started a tradition in the last few years where if we get a couple of deer down or an elk or something, we get the family together at my parents' house and make it into a processing party and have a bunch of chili and beers, and it's a fun way to do work.
Yeah.
So that gave me all of pretty much most of October off. So I was working and not hunting, which is a weird thing for me in October. I'm usually hitting it pretty hard. But then my brother and I were able to pencil in a few more dates to get back to Montana for general elk season. And so, would be, about 10 days. Not quite. It would have been a week ago on Sunday. So I don't know, a week, 10 days ago, we went back out to Montana. It's a general rifle season now. So a lot more people out there once you get through archery season. You know, like you mentioned, the Orange Army, you certainly get that vibe at times. But we've been hunting in the area enough to know where you can kind of get away from folks and similar manner where we were checking off a bunch of spots. There wasn't a lot of elk sign. So we were staying mobile until we really got onto stuff. We were able to locate a few herds that were on private, but near publicly accessible areas. So it turned into a little bit of a roll the dice type situation where it's like, you know, they're feeding out on this pivot or this alfalfa field, and it seems like they're going to feed into this direction, which would hit state land or, you know, might hit block management, which is Montana's private land for public hunting. And so we played that game for a few days. We got close to some elk, but never in an area that we could hunt. And that led us to our last day, which would have been last Sunday. And, we hit a spot that we've hunted before in the morning, and my brother and brother-in-law had gotten cows there this past season. Didn't see anything, and so we started to move north to some other spots. We were going to check on a kind of a last day, last ditch effort, try and cover a lot of ground. And on our way to the next spot, we were driving through essentially between two different mountain ranges and agriculture in the middle. And we're driving through this, you know, egg, and this goes back to that cookie crumb earlier of knowing those little pockets of publicly accessible or publicly public hunting land, even in areas where you think you might not ever hunt. We were driving along and we see a big brown and white barn and then a herd of like 60 elk. And we're like, whoa, there's a bunch of elk there just off the side of the highway. You know, right in the middle of private, nothing you could do about it at the moment. But I feel like with OnX, what a lot of people do in that situation is like, well, let me check OnX. Who knows? Maybe there's something nearby. And sure enough, there was a couple of chunks of big block management units, not that far from where those elk were. And we keep driving down the highway. And my brother and I are talking, and I say, you know, it's probably not a bad idea. So the way that block works in Montana is you have to sign in at most of these. It's up to the landowner, but most landowners require that you sign in at a checkbox. You put your name, address, contact info into the box, and then you're allowed to hunt. But you can't just drive up and hunt the area without checking into their property. And so I was like, it's probably not a bad idea to go sign in to these properties that are, you know, near the elk, even though they're not huntable right now. You know, they're probably going to move off of this private ranch at some point today. And so that's what we did. But on the way, we're formulating this plan, and we look to the side of the road again off the highway, and it's like, oh, there's a bigger herd of elk. So there was like a herd of like 100 to 150, a couple ranches down. So we kept the same plan. We went north where the elk were at and signed into a couple of the ranches that are open for public hunting, and then just looped around basically and got to a spot that was about a mile and a half from where the elk were, but you could see them from the vantage point. And so we spent the rest of the morning just watching these elk from a distance, and they were getting some hunting pressure from, you know, outfitters and private landowners and stuff. And it turned out that there was a herd of about 400 or 500 that had come down out of the mountains to feed onto that. You know, we talked about the kind of their migration winter patterns that had come down out of the mountain to feed into some of that private. And, so slowly throughout the day, that big herd kind of split into smaller herds of, you know, like 20 to 50 elk and moved around. And, long story short, we just watched them from a distance, and they kept moving to the north, which was towards one of these small pieces of block management. And, you know, it's just one of those things where it's like, it's just a little hay field. It's maybe 500 yards by 1,000 yards total. Mm-hmm. So it's not a big piece. And it's just flat. It's just a flat hay field. So you drive by it and you're like, there's no reason that anyone would ever plan to go elk hunting on this property. But these elk just had been moving north, and we were watching them from about a mile away, and they kept moving and kept moving. And it kind of got to the point where they were getting pressure from other areas, but not from the north. And, you know, my brother and I are checked into this piece of property, and it's like, you know, it seems like the move at this point is to just go get on that piece of private land and hang out, and, you know, maybe luck is on our side and those elk move onto that piece of property. And, we decide to make that move. And it was like a 5 minute drive from where we had been glassing to where we could access that piece of property. And I thought we were looking at maybe like a, you know, like a hour long waiting match to see which direction these elk move. And within the 5 minutes of us driving from where we were glassing to where we could access that property, the elk moved that entire distance and were on the public hunting property by the time we parked. So it went from a very casual, like, oh, we'll sit and wait it out, to like, oh, we've got to get in there right now. And so we parked the truck, hiked in. I mean, it was like a climb over the fence. The elk are moving through this property fast. So it's a scenario where it's like, you got to get in and get set fast. You're also trying not to bump them off of the property. It's just a totally different experience than hunting elk up in the mountains, which I love to do. I had done it, you know, like a few weeks prior.
You're almost
white. And so it was a herd of about,
just waiting.
Yeah. Yeah. It felt a lot more like deer hunting. So we got into the unit. It was a herd of about 15 elk, similar to what you had seen, where it was like spikes and cows, but there was one raghorn bull. I feel like this is the part of the story where I should apologize to my brother. I'm a lot taller and long-legged than he is, so I just took off sprinting, which kind of left him in the dust. And so I didn't have in my mind that I was going to be the one to shoot the bull. We both had general tags, and so either of us could have shot a cow or a bull in this unit. I just happened to be a little faster than him. And now after the fact, I feel bad about it. In the moment, it was just the instinct of like, oh, you got to make something happen right now. So I take off running and I get to within maybe 150 yards of the herd. They're kind of moving back and forth, trying to decide which direction they're going. And, I just set up and waited for a clear window where the bull would step out and not have any cows in front of him or behind him. Made a good shot, first shot. They all whirled and ran back the direction they had just came. And the bull kind of fell back to the back of the herd, but didn't drop. They ran back to where they had come onto that piece of property. I was able to get another good shot on him. Again, elk are tough animals. At that point, the bull dropped down behind a couple of small trees, and my brother was able to make two clean shots on a cow and dropped his cow there. And then I had to go finish my bull off, which he took three shots to the vitals before tipping over, which I feel like those animals amaze me every time. You know, like you shoot an animal, you feel like it's a good shot and you don't see him tip over and you start to question your abilities or whether or not it was as good of a shot as you thought. And there were three shots all, you know, on or behind the front shoulder, nothing wrong with any of them, but they're tough animals. So, in a very quick order, we went from having, you know, no elk last day to we've got a bull and a cow down and it's our last day here. So we've better hurry up and get these things, you know, quartered up and packed out. And we're fortunate enough to have some friends in the area that came and helped us get them out of there. So, and that area depends on the property you're hunting. In this area specifically, you have to get the whole animal out. So we quartered them, and then they brought us a game sled, and we put the carcass on the game sled and hauled that out and disposed of that properly. So it's one of those things where it pays to know those little units. Where you think, you know, I might never hunt this, but it pays to know those units. But on the flip side of that, some of that stuff has, you know, weird regulations. So make sure you're checking and you know what's legal and what's not before you just jump onto a little piece of private property and start hunting. So,
man, yeah. What a like whirlwind of elk adventures.
And I think it'll probably be the only time in my life where I have the opportunity to shoot two bulls in one season, and I'm grateful for it. I don't take it for granted. It was
I'm gonna start tagging along hunting elk with you.
You're more than welcome. I don't foresee this being a long term trend, but I'd be happy.
You're like, flash forward to 2024. You're like, this year I shot three elk. You know, no, congrats, man. It's awesome. No, I hope that didn't sound like animosity, because it wasn't. I'm super stoked for you.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate it. I'm pushing my own comfort level with the dry aging stuff. So my brother and I decided that we're going to let our elk dry age for 2 weeks before processing. So we shot last Sunday, and we're waiting until this coming Sunday to process them. So I'll report
Have you weighed it at all? Did you weigh it before? See how much
I did not weigh it, but I can tell you. So the bull that I shot in the Black Hills was a mature 6-point. And he was, I've shot a handful of elk now. He was by far the biggest elk body wise. His hindquarters were enormous. You know, it took all my strength to lift those up. This is like his body compared to, and his quarters compared to this, you know, smaller 2.5 year old Raghorn that I shot in Montana. Drastically different. I would say that the hindquarters of the smaller bull are probably 30% smaller, 30 to 35% smaller. It's crazy how much difference there can be between a mature bull and a younger bull.
Wow, that's crazy. Yeah, it shows like those years pack it on.
Yeah, it seems like usually we get at least 200 pounds of processed meat out of a bull. I'm sure it'll be more than that for my South Dakota elk, and maybe a touch less for the one from Montana, but it's a lot of meat.
So I'll close with this quickly, because we're like way over our normal time. Normally we do like an hour, but
Just do another plans? 40 minutes and then do a part one and part two.
Yeah, right. any special like culinary plans you've got with the elk? Like, I just helped a guy do a bunch of sausage with his elk. So anything like
that? You read my mind, actually. You mentioned our pig camp, which everybody that is interested should check out. A couple seats left. I am almost out of pig meat, and I am out of the wild sausage, the wild chorizo that I made, and so. We've been out of sausage since all summer. We didn't have sausage this summer, which was a huge bummer. And we don't really do the whole store-bought meat thing. So it was a sausage-less summer, which no one likes a sausage-less summer. So that's the plan. With the first one, I just did grind, and then all the traditional cuts. Roasts and steaks, and then with this one, I knew if I got a second one, I'd be doing a lot more experimenting. So you actually sent me a couple of sausage recipes that you'd tried out recently, so I might try my hand at some of those. And then I have an old standby country sausage recipe, which I don't think is a very official term, but the person that I stole the recipe from calls it country sausage, and essentially it's just kind of like a what I would consider a base sausage. It's got some crushed red pepper and sage in it, but you can add Italian seasoning or, Mexican seasoning and kind of flare it up towards anything. So I use it for breakfast. I use it for, you know, pasta. I use it for a bunch of different stuff. So I'll do a bunch of that too.
Nice. Sorry. There was a bit of a lag we were experiencing.
No worries.
Between the two of us. So, sausage sounds great. I still have some. I made some variety of pork sausages. I mean, you see the recipes. I still got to write them up and get them up on the website, but they'll transfer over to any two. I think that the green chili sausage, I think with elk, will be really good too. I think you'll like that.
That's one. That was the one that you sent over. That one's on the top of the list. Sounds really good.
Yeah, I've got a boudin recipe too. It would probably be good with the elk as well. Did you save any of the innards?
I did on the one from Montana. Yep.
Nice.
That
boudin sauce, some liver, that may be good.
I would love to do that. I should note too, I normally do either a Thanksgiving or a Christmas venison ham, but I don't know that I'll have a deer this year. So if I don't get a deer, my backup plan is to take probably like the sirloin or something off one of the bowls, and rather than curing an entire hind quarter, just curing one roast from the elk. I've kind of trialed that with a mule deer in the past, and it seems to work just as well as doing the whole hind quarter. So I don't think doing a whole elk quarter would cure very well, and it would take up a lot of space in my fridge for the two weeks that it would take to cure. So, and that's a big commitment to elk ham. I think, you know, one sirloin or one bottom round or something would be plenty.
Yeah, I think you get away with the sirloin too. I mean, that's like sirloin, what, like that's your football roast, and that's like a whole football. It's like a rugby ball.
Yeah.
So, all right, well, our connection for whatever reason is getting a bit spotty, and then we've run out of time, so I'm going to go ahead and close us out. Casey, you got any last thoughts before we close out?
Be an opportunist, I guess, would be my sentiment. I feel like I was just really lucky this year. Not in that I didn't hunt hard, but in that I drew multiple tags and ended up getting a bowl on the last day of one of the seasons. It doesn't always work out that way, but be an opportunist in that, you know, take the opportunities when you get them, make the most of them, and don't be afraid to try a tactic or try an area that you haven't before.
No, I think that's awesome. And for me, I'd say if you want to get into the Western hunting, if you want to get into sort of getting out and exploring as you hunt, sort of like that explore, scout, hunt mentality of what we'll call it, like the modern mobile Western hunter. I mean, you can apply to the East too as well, I guess, if you're moving through public land in the East or private land as well. Like, you know, be willing to change, be susceptible to change, know that you can plan things to go one particular way for your entire thought process of the trip. And then at the end, you know, on your second or third day, you may have to change everything completely, and just keep that in the back of your mind. Excuse me. Still battling whatever it is that I'm battling, not COVID, but it's a remote podcast anyway, so you don't have to worry, Casey. But I would say, yeah, just go out, you know, at the end of the day too, have fun, judge your condition, judge the signs, look for the animals you want to hunt, enjoy your hunt. Hopefully you come back with stuff. I know we're getting into the heaviest part of hunting season right now, so I just want to wish everybody luck. And then two, pig camp coming up next month in December, waterfowl camp coming up in January. We've got those cool animal shirts on there. This is our first live podcast that we've ever done, aside from like in-person ones up at the BHA Rendezvous. So if you folks like it, please let us know. We'll try to figure out to do this again. We'll plan a little better and make some announcements and all that fun jazz so we can get it on your schedule and do some Q&A and stuff like that as well. So whatever thoughts you have around that, please let us know. And then whatever podcast platform you're listening to, or YouTube or Facebook or LinkedIn, wherever you're tuning in from, give us a like, give us a follow, give us a share. And then if you're on a podcast platform, punch that 5-star button, leave us a review, tell us what we're doing wrong, or, you know, tell us what we're doing right. And I say, thanks, everybody. Have a good night.